for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. When we hear the words Duke Lacrosse, many of us remember 2006, when three members of the team were accused of sexual assault. Despite the overwhelming media attention the case received and the public debate it sparked, author and Duke alum William Cohen says many questions went unanswered. He joins me in the studio to talk about his new book. It's titled The Price of Silence, The Duke Lacrosse Scandal, The Power of the Elite, and the Corruption of Our Great Universities. If you'd like to be part of the program, give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. William Cohen, it's good to see you.
It's great to be back here again, Diane.
Thank you. You're a Duke alum, and you've gone back and written a 600-page book here. Why'd you decide to go back and look at this case again?
Well, Diane, so, you know, I spent 17 years on Wall Street, and in the last 10 years, I've written three best-selling books about Wall Street. The easiest thing for me to do would have been to just write another book about Wall Street. That's what I think my publisher wanted me to do and things like that. But I decided that I had too many open questions in my mind about what happened at my alma mater, which I love, about what happened during this incident between March of 2006, when the party occurred, and April 2007, when Roy Cooper, the Attorney General of the state of North Carolina, declared these boys innocent. I wanted to know what happened. There was no trial in this case. I wanted this book to serve as the trial that never happened.
Tell me about whom you were able to speak with early on.
So, you know, that's a very interesting question. It shouldn't be, but it is. And the name of the book is The Price of Silence. I was able to speak to people who had never spoken before about this, like Mike Nifong. Everybody wanted to talk to Mike Nifong in 2006 and 2007.
And remind us who he was.
He was the Durham district attorney that decided to prosecute this case. You know, viewers have to, or listeners have to remember that this was the Flight 370. This was the Bridgegate of 2006. I mean, this was major league media attention on this case around the clock. And people like Mike Nifong, you know, said a lot at the beginning and then were silent. This is the first time he's spoken about this case since then.
And you also talked with Robert Steele, chair of the Duke Board of Trustees.
Yes, after Duke University, my alma mater, told him not to talk to me, tried to silence him, but he courageously wanted his version of this story out. He wanted to say what had happened here, and he was more than happy to talk to me.
But, you know, it's interesting you begin the book not with lacrosse but with basketball at Duke. How come?
Well, because when it comes to Duke, I think everybody recognizes that the premier religion at Duke is Duke basketball. Mike Krzyzewski, you know, the greatest college coach of all time. And it starts, the book starts in June of 2004 when the new president of Duke, Dick Broadhead, gets to Duke. It's even, he's supposed to start July 1st, but he actually shows up at the end of June, unpacks his bag in his office. He's just was the dean of Yale College, one of the most highly respected scholars in the country, always wanted to be a university president, said that he turned down other offers until Duke came along. And the first thing that he encounters, even while he's unpacking his bag, while he's mentally unpacking his bags, the athletic director comes into his office and says, oh, by the way, Mike Krzyzewski is threatening to leave to go to the Los Angeles Lakers, where they've offered him a five-year, $40 million contract, $8 million a year. You know, even before you, you know, open your office here, Dick, you're going to have to deal with the fact that Mike Krzyzewski is potentially going to the Los Angeles Lakers.
So how does that then take us to 2006 and remind us what happened in March?
So, obviously, Coach K decided to stay. Dick Broadhead dodged a bullet. You know, they increased his compensation. They did all sorts of other things to make it more attractive to him. He's clearly the single most powerful person at Duke and the highest paid person at Duke. And so the message is that athletics and athletes and student athletes are very, very important to Duke. And that's very different than the message he probably got at Yale. So that, you know, come March 2006, it's spring break. The lacrosse team is on campus. They're basically the only team on campus. It had been a tradition, apparently, for 15 years to have a big party on the lacrosse team during this time. The guys, after practice, decided in the afternoon it would be a great thing to have to have a party all day.
And this is March 14th.
March 13th of 2006, going into the early morning hours of March 14th.
Right.
And at about midnight, they decided to invite two strippers. They paid $400 to them each, with the idea, incredibly, that they were going to put on a show for 2 hours. After about 5 minutes of dancing and all sorts of, I would say, vulgar behavior that the boys evidenced, which I track in the book, can't really say on family radio show. The women left, and later one of them accused three of the boys of raping her and sexually assaulting and kidnapping her.
Kidnapping her?
Well, kidnapping her in the sense of keeping her in this bathroom against her will.
And you talked with her?
Yes, I talked with her. Also, for the first time that she's spoken publicly about this, I met with her in a Durham jail while she was awaiting a trial on a completely separate matter of murdering her boyfriend, which is, of course, shocking. Last November, that trial occurred, and she was found guilty of murdering her boyfriend. She's now serving up to 18 years in prison for that crime.
But at the time, she and she alone claimed that she had been forcefully sexually assaulted.
Yes, that is true. She claimed that. She was the one in the bathroom with what she claimed was these three players. She left the house. She didn't make any claim when she left the house with the other dancer. She would not communicate her name or where she lived. So the other dancer brought her to a Kroger supermarket parking lot in Durham, whereupon a security guard at the Kroger, it was early in the morning, called the police. The police came. They tried to get her out of the car. She was not responsive. They gave her smelling salts. It woke her up. They eventually took her to something called Durham Access. While she was at Durham Access, they asked her what had happened. She said, "I was raped." They immediately took her to the Duke University Hospital. She was examined by a nurse, and for the first time, the nurse's report is in my book. That had never been released before.
Why not?
It was deemed to be a private document, a secure document, a non-public document. And so it never came out before I was able to get a copy of it. A lot of defense attorneys sort of made hay with it about what they thought it said. But now, for the first time, you know, people can see actually what it said. And in there, she tells a story. Crystal Mangum, the victim slash, and she was later known as the accuser when the story turned, but she told the story of how these guys, unnamed guys, had raped and sexually assaulted her. And Tara Levesey, the nurse who examined her that night and early that morning, basically believed her and wrote that in the report. Now, of course, the defense has made all sorts of hay about this, that she was an unqualified nurse, that she was a feminist, and therefore she was biased against, you know, the players and was very sympathetic.
How did they justify the claim that she was not really qualified to make that assessment.
Because she had gotten her certification on March 1st of 2006, but she hadn't gotten it in the mail until she actually went home that night on March 14th. So they said, okay, well, she wasn't technically certified because she hadn't actually got her certification. Then she was from Maine. And when she was in Maine, she had, I guess, produced a play at the university in Maine, the Vagina Monologues play. And the defense decided that she was biased and a feminist. So therefore, she couldn't objectively assess what happened to Crystal Mangum.
Was there a second assessment at the time? Was there someone else who confirmed the evidence?
Well, there was also a doctor who there were many doctors who examined Crystal. There were many police who talked to her. The police investigators from Durham spent a lot of time with Crystal. They obviously believed much of her story. They believed she was assaulted.
Did they write that?
Yes.
In a
report? Oh, yes,
report?
They did. One of the things that Mike Nifong told me, the Durham district attorney, was that had the players given DNA test voluntarily, which they decided ultimately not to do, had they done that voluntarily, there would not have been a Duke LaCrosse case.
William Cohen, his new book is titled The Price of Silence, The Duke LaCrosse Scandal, The Power of the Elite, and The Corruption of Our Great Universities. Short break here, right back. Here's our first email following our earlier portion of the conversation about William Cohen's new book, The Price of Silence. This from Mercedes, who says, Mr. Cohen has expressed his belief that something happened to Crystal Mangum at the Duke LaCrosse party on March 13th. Or 14, because it happened after midnight. I would like to know, based on his research, what he believes happened in that bathroom. Does he believe that the three indicted players are not innocent?
So that is a very simple question that is complex to answer.
Tough.
Of course. Because the first thing, Diane, is we will never know what happened in that bathroom. It's kind of, as Donald Rumsfeld would say, an unknown unknown. We won't know, in part because the people who are in that bathroom aren't talking.
Even she.
She told me at the Durham County Jail that she believes she was assaulted with a broomstick in that bathroom. Okay? Fact number one. Okay, Mike Nifong, the Durham district attorney, that nobody in this case wants to hear from. They want Mike Nifong They won't be happy until Mike Nifong is buried in the ground.
He was actually disbarred, was he?
He was disbarred. He was fired. He filed for personal bankruptcy. He spent a day. He's the only person in this case to spend time in jail. He spent a day in jail for contempt of court. But he was a 28-year veteran of that office.
Prosecutor.
He was extremely well-respected before this case came along. And all of a sudden, everybody wants to say he had no judgment and he was just out for political gain. And this was all a vendetta against Duke students, where both his parents both went to Duke. He got into Duke and chose to go to UNC. They just make him out to be an incredible villain. And I'm sorry, and this is going to make all the haters hate me all the more. I don't believe it. Okay, I believe he was an honorable man trying to get to the bottom of what happened.
All right. Now, take us back to the Duke University Hospital once again. Did any of the evidence indicate that this young woman had been assaulted with a broomstick?
Well, that night, when she was examined, I don't think she said anything. I mean, there was discussion about a broomstick and the threat of using a broomstick. The broomstick idea is something that she told me later, okay? That was new information that was not mentioned that night. That night, she said she was assaulted, she was raped, which means that she was, that a non-broomstick was used. That she was actually raped and sexually assaulted by the three men.
She said she was anally.
Anally and vaginally assaulted.
All right.
By three of the men at the same, basically at the same time. And that was a story that she stuck to for a long time until December of 2006, when she was, so this is sort of 9 months into this controversy, when she was interviewed by one of Mike Nifong's investigators. And at that, during that interview, which was, you know, transcribed and put on, written down, she said she could no longer remember whether she was assaulted by a penis that night. And so Mike Nifong dropped the rape charge, kept the sexual assault charge and the kidnapping charge in December. And then in January of 2007, because the state bar had filed complaints against Nifong, he recused himself from the case, and he turned it over to the state attorney general.
Tell me why Nifong recused himself.
You have to give the defense attorneys in this case an incredible amount of credit for the way they represented their clients. They are powerful people in the state of North Carolina. They are well-respected lawyers in the state of North Carolina. The state bar in North Carolina, until this point, had basically been a powerless sort of mamby-pamby organization that never disciplined any district attorneys. For the first time, they decided that Mike Nifong needed to be disciplined. He needed to be removed from the case. Why? The first charge was because during the first or second week of March, or after he had the case, he was on TV everywhere talking about his belief that these kids had done this, committed this crime. He was everywhere. And the second part of it was related to DNA evidence that the defense believed that Mike Nifong withheld. I don't believe he withheld it. He turned all the DNA evidence over to the defense during the course of the procedural part.
What kind of DNA is he accused of having withheld?
The DNA, the tests. There were two sets of tests. Okay. First, the state investigatory arm took the DNA that the boys were compelled to give. Remember, I said that had they given the DNA voluntarily, there may not have been a Duke lacrosse case. But they originally said they would give the DNA voluntarily. Then they said they wouldn't, and then a state judge compelled them in a non-testimonial order to give the DNA. They all traipsed down to the Durham police station to give the DNA. Those DNA samples were sent off to a state lab. They came back negative for the Duke lacrosse players. Nifong then took more DNA samples and turned it over to a private lab, and that too came back with no evidence of no evidence from these players on Crystal Mangum's body, in or on, as they like to say. Okay? Now, the defense attorneys claim that Mike Nifong withheld that information from them, but that's just simply not true. He turned it all over to them months before there was going to be any trial. He didn't make it easy for them. He didn't put a nice bow around it. He made them dig through it and find out that there was DNA evidence from other men on in and on her, not related to the Duke players. So, of course, they then trumpeted that information publicly, and then they had the state bar file a complaint against Nifong for claiming to so-called withhold this evidence. But obviously, he didn't withhold the evidence because they found it.
So they found the evidence, which it sounds as though could have been exculpatory.
Yes, the whole. I'm not a lawyer, so then there's the whole debate about exculpatory and inculpatory. Basically, Mike Nifong, what he told me was that the absence of evidence is an evidence of absence. Happens to be a same phrase that Donald Rumsfeld used in the new Errol Morris movie. But the fact of the matter is there was rape cases brought in Durham and in jurisdictions all over this country before DNA evidence was used, before they even had DNA testing. Rape trials occurred all across the country. And basically, just because his view, this is Mike Nifong's view, just because there was no DNA evidence doesn't mean something didn't happen in that bathroom.
Okay, here's what I'd like to understand. You said that one of the other strippers took the young woman into her car, went to a parking lot. Where police approached. Now, what does the other young woman say?
Okay, so this is complicated too. Okay, at first, the other woman was not in the bathroom with Crystal.
Right.
So it's basically hearsay.
Right.
At first, what she said was, it's a crock. It never happened. Then she changed her story and said that, actually, it could have happened. I don't know for sure. I wasn't there, but it could have happened. The defense says she changed her story because there was an outstanding warrant for her arrest for a parole violation, and that the quid pro quo, they claim, again, defense has a big conspiracy theory about all this, was that Nifong had conspired with the other stripper in exchange for reducing her payment related to her outstanding warrant, that she would change her story. But she's basically not findable. I couldn't find her. I don't know where she is.
Interesting.
And, but the last point was that, you know, she made was that it's quite possible that this happened, but I don't know.
All right. The remainder of the subtitle of your book is The Corruption of Our Great Universities. What are you referring to?
I'm referring to the fact that, number one, that the emphasis on sports and big-time sports and the status that athletes get at universities all across this country is just a fact of life that is corrupting. We see that now going on, playing out in real time, because we're just coming off the NCAA basketball championship where billions of dollars go to these schools. And we see that, of course, none of that money goes to the student athletes. And we see that the Northwestern football team is, of course, trying to change that in real time. And you can see what happened, at Duke. There's a $50 million sports budget. Basically, sports at Duke doesn't really make any money, so that's basically a gift from the university to the athletic department to enable those sports to happen. The basketball program does make money, of course, under Coach K. But this party, in the end, Duke settled with these kids for reasons that are mystifying to me, paid them $20 million each. And this party has cost Duke upwards of $100 million between legal fees and PR fees and investigations and settlements. And I wanted to know why. Why did my university spend this money? And I feel like, they got corrupted in the process.
Here's an email from Lisa, who says, please address the issue of the culture of the men's lacrosse team, whose end-of-year celebrations included a stripper. For these young men to have been wrongly convicted and to serve jail time would certainly have been unjust, but they put themselves in a position to have that happen by having a stripper at the party. The issue of the exploitation of women was never addressed, and the lacrosse players risked their freedom by their thinking it was okay to celebrate with a stripper present.
I agree with that email. I think that because of the pedestal that the lacrosse players were put on at Duke, they were allowed to get away with a lot of bad behavior, misdemeanor kind of behavior, underage drinking, public urination, noise. I mean, if you look at the analysis of the quote-unquote crimes in this, or the misdemeanors that occurred at Duke during this period and the years leading up to it, fully half of them were committed by the lacrosse team players. So there was this culture of being able to get away with things, and the women who followed them were called lacrostitutes, and so that they had the, you know, complete devotion of many of the women at Duke too, in a way that was not healthy.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here is an email from Michael, who says, as the father of a former Division I lax recruit, I can personally attest to the terrible lacrosse party culture. It's been that way for many years. Lacrosse is a rich kid's contact sport. Most Division I players come from the most exclusive private high schools, have led a life of promiscuity and entitlement. I know of many parents who rue the day their son chose lacrosse over any other sport. That's a pretty broad statement.
Yes, it is a pretty broad statement. It is a sport that has been predominantly played at private schools in the Northeast and in the Northeastern corridor. Recently, a couple years ago, the Princeton coach moved to the University of Denver and started a program there. But lacrosse isn't played in Stanford, for instance. It's really played east of the Mississippi, by and large, except for the University of Denver. And it's basically played, as you said, by the sons of well-to-do parents. And by the way, as is their right, the parents of these kids, of course, had a bottomless pit of money to spend on the defense. Had the tables been turned, had it been, you know, black players and poor black players, they wouldn't have, and they would not have had the money for this defense, and who knows what would have happened.
There were lots of concerns over alcohol use at schools across the country.
Well, Diane, this is one thing that I've come to learn. Underage drinking is a national epidemic. The drinking age is 21. So everybody knows that administrators at these colleges and universities are turning a blind eye, certainly every weekend, maybe even every day, to the underage drinking that's going on. Duke tried to grapple with it by, Duke has a West Campus and an East Campus. This house was off of East Campus. The excessive partying was going on in the neighborhood called Trinity Park off of East Campus. It had been going on for years, and the neighbors were getting increasingly upset, and they kept pushing the Durham police to do something about it. Finally, at the beginning of 2005-2006 school year, they determined they were going to do something about it and crack down, and they did crack down. But the lacrosse players, with impunity, kept having these parties and were basically asking for the police to come and you know, challenge them on it. And they had this party. Interestingly, which Mike Nifong pointed out, normally when the police would come to these parties, of course, people would still be at the party. But at this particular party, they came to the party, you know, at 1 in the morning or whatever it was, and none of the players were there. Everyone was gone. Everyone had disappeared. Now, that is, according to Mike Nifong, very strange behavior. You know, if you hadn't done anything wrong, why did everybody have to flee? When Reed Seligman, one of the players who was indicted, says, you know, his alibi was he took a cab at whatever 12, 13 or whatever time it was. He asked for that cab to come not to the house where the party was, but at a house around the corner. Why did he do that?
William Cohen, book The Price of Silence, all about the Duke LaCrosse scandal. Short break here. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Reputation.com, with tools to help businesses and professionals manage online reviews and control search results. Learn more at 1-800-REPUTATION. By Athena Health, committed to helping physicians manage change with cloud-based services plus Epocrates mobile tools. AthenaHealth.com. And by Arizona State University, with more than 60 campus degrees now available 100% online at online.asu.edu. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, how antibiotics, cesarean sections, and sanitizers are destroying the balance of the human microbiome, the massive collection of microorganisms that live in and on our bodies. We talk with Dr. Martin Blaser, who speculates that changes in the microbiome may be contributing to obesity, asthma, and allergies. Join us.
And welcome back. If you've just joined us, William Cohen is my guest. He's written a new book, this time about the Duke LaCrosse scandal. It's titled The Price of Silence. The subtitle also goes on The Power of the Elite and the Corruption of Our Great Universities. William Cohen is, of course, the author of the New York Times bestsellers, Money and Power, and House of Cards. Here's an email from Malcolm, who says, one thing your guest failed to mention was that the DA, the prosecutor Nifong, was in a heated reelection campaign.
Oh, that is, of course, quite true, and I think I referred to that as well, but I'm happy to reiterate the fact that he was appointed the DA in 2005 when the then-current DA was appointed a judge. He then, at the end of 2005, declared himself to be a candidate for the seat himself after 28 years being an underling. He was actively campaigning to become the DA at the beginning of the year of 2006. He had two opponents. And then in March of 2006, this happened. So the defense and the critics will say he just used this case to promote his political ambitions because Durham is 45% black, so he's just going to appeal to the black community. I mean, I think that is total rubbish. He didn't. He has already a declared candidate in January of 2006. This case comes around in March 2006. He realizes it's going to be volatile and important, and he just happened to find out about the case by reading this non-testimonial order that appeared on a copy machine a week after the case had started. And so for his critics to complain that he was just exploiting this for political purposes, I don't think is fair.
Here is an email from Andrew. Did you speak with any of the Duke 88 faculty members, and what happened to those faculty members?
Yes, I spoke to a number of the faculty members. Understandably, they still work there, and even though they're tenured, they never wanted their names to be used because they're very scared. There's still legal proceedings going on. There's still lawsuits. Lawyers have been sending professors threatening letters about make sure they don't talk to the media, don't share any documents with the media. Everything is subject to litigation. So the answer is I did speak to them. Many of them, of course, are still – they remain adamant with their original position, the group of 88, that something happened here and that none of us would be proud of. They had a chance to reiterate that view or decide not to pursue that view anymore a year later in March of 2007, and they reiterated their view despite knowing that the kids were soon to be declared innocent.
All right, let's go to Terry in Hicksville, Ohio. Hi, Terry.
Hi.
You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. First, based on this, I probably am not going to give a donation this year. I am just shocked that a program would basically publish something I would call propaganda. As you pointed out, you are not an attorney. As an attorney, I can say the real injustice here is the district attorney didn't go to jail longer. What you described on the air is a violation of code of ethics. When you force the defendants to find evidence before you turn it over, that's a violation of ethics. Also, it was a violation of ethics to threaten to prosecute a cab driver if he didn't change his testimony. And the reason that Duke didn't want to go to trial, because they got their clock cleaned, and what came out was a true corrupting influence in our colleges today, which is a left-wing fanatical feminism that is so pervasive on campus.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling.
I'm not sure there's a question there.
He mentioned a cab driver.
Okay, so the cab driver that he's talking about was the cab driver that drove Reed Seligman, picked him up at the house around the corner from the house where this party occurred, which is very strange, then took him to the cash machine where he could, of course, be photographed taking cash out, and then to a restaurant, the cookout restaurant, to get some food, and then back to his dorm. Basically, Mr. Mustafa, the cab driver, was saying, you know, gave an affidavit saying, I picked him up here, I took him here, and this formed the basis of Reed Seligman's alibi, which actually seems quite credible. Mike Nifong thinks that alibi is sort of convenient. If you did something wrong, if you didn't do anything wrong, why did you have the cab pick him up around the corner? And if you were trying to establish an alibi, of course you would go to an ATM machine and then a restaurant and then pay a big tip to the cab driver and all of this. So Mike Nifong has doubts about Reed Seligman's alibi. It seems pretty airtight to me, but nevertheless, what this caller is referring to is that the cab driver had driven a woman, totally separately, had driven a woman to the mall where she went into a store and stole some handbags, and then he drove the woman home, okay? And there was an outstanding warrant for his arrest for sort of aiding and abetting this stealing of the handbags crime. And this was dug up when his name surfaced in the providing the alibi for Reed Seligman. And so the defense, of course, made a big deal about how somehow Nifong was manipulating the cab driver with this outstanding warrant and forced him to go to trial. He was found not guilty, of course, of having anything to do with the stealing of the handbags, and he didn't change his story. So again, you know, there's so much misinformation. I mean, one thing that I am amazed at, you know, when we're talking about DNA, is one of the players in the house who was living at the house, who was one of the co-captains, Matt Zash, said that he had moved. Crystal Mangum was wearing plastic fake fingernails. He said that he had moved and thrown those fake plastic fingernails, which came off in a struggle, into the wastebasket. Okay? And there was no DNA evidence of his on those fingernails. However, there was DNA evidence on those fingernails of David Evans, one of the indicted players, at least with 98% certainty that they matched his DNA. And she said, Crystal Mangum said, from the beginning that she struggled in that bathroom and she was fighting for her life, and that's why her fake fingernails came off. Now, so if she hadn't struggled, why did her fake fingernails come off? And if she hadn't struggled, why was David Evans' DNA on those fingernails? Now, the defense will say because he's the one that put them in the wastebasket. But in fact, it was Matt Zash who put them in the wastebasket. And they never explained that. And of course, nobody wants to talk about that.
All right. To Thomas in Kinston, North Carolina. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, hello. So I can't help but think that these gentlemen in the media were being persecuted heavily simply for the fact that they had strippers at a campus party. And people saw that as chauvinistic, saw these men as elitists, okay? Well, my question is, would Duke University have reacted the same way if they became aware of other provocative behaviors happening on campus, whether it was a homosexual swingers ring or something of that nature? And my argument is that they wouldn't, because we accept homosexuality in all its forms now, but we are intent on persecuting wealthy white males, you know, for things that, you know, affect our sensibilities. And I think it's a very unfair way to look at this case. And that's...
Well, first of all, it was a lot more than just having strippers at that party. You need to read, you know, what was in the police reports that I can include in the book. Part of the three of the players who lived at the house, Matt Zash, Dan Flannery and David Evans voluntarily gave statements to the police about what happened that night. And in those statements, it's clear that there's more going on than just dancing and underage drinking. Okay, there were racial epithets thrown. There was provocative statements with a broomstick made about how they were going to assault the dancers with a broomstick. It was very, very ugly behavior. Again, nothing that anyone would be proud of. It may not have been criminal behavior. As I say, we will not know. Obviously, Mike Nifong and Crystal Mangum still believe there was criminal behavior in that bathroom. A lot of people would say they have absolutely no credibility. You know, I think what I tried to do for the first time, as I said, was present in a fair and balanced way all of the evidence that I could dig up. And I dug up a lot of evidence. And I talked to everybody who would talk to me. And even the people who wouldn't talk to me, I presented fairly and honestly their point of view. So I think the reader should, you know, hopefully, if they're interested, read this book and we'll see for the first time all of the evidence. And they can decide for themselves whether or not justice really was served here.
And here is an email from Paul, who says, I live in Durham. I'm a researcher in the Duke community. I obviously cannot speak to the disputed facts of the case. I can speak to the culture of privilege and entitlement that pervade Duke. One day, shortly after the case, I was working in the library when the lacrosse players entered, all clad in shirts, mocking Nifong and his charge that they were hoodlums. They showed absolutely no regard for the other library patrons as they talked about their latest drunken exploits in the most lewd of terms. I wish to stress, I view this as a culture that has compromised the integrity of the individuals involved. However, that Duke and other universities failed to address this is truly troubling.
And I think he's absolutely right. And this is my alma mater. You would have thought that this incident would have evoked a great amount of introspection. And at first there was. Dick Broadhead, the president, created all these committees, a culture committee, a lacrosse committee, a this committee and that committee. And he seemed quite serious about addressing underage drinking and the lacrostitutes and the privilege and the elitism and all the misdemeanors that the lacrosse players had committed with impunity up to that point. It seemed like there was a real desire to change. But once the narrative changed, once it suddenly seemed that Nifong was out on a limb and that Crystal Mangum was bipolar and was making all of this up, and then it got thrown out by the state attorney general, Roy Cooper, after a four-month investigation that he won't let anybody see or he won't give interviews about this, that all seems to have faded away. And, you know, even in recent years, I mean, we know about the Duke porn star from this fall, which was big news for a while. There were Asia-themed parties at Duke that were, again, I'm a Duke alum and a loyal Duke alum. I find this kind of behavior reprehensible. There was Karen Owen, who decided it would be a great idea to put a PowerPoint together to discuss all the men she had sex with while she was at Duke, and it went viral in public. I don't understand what's going on at this university, which is my alma mater, and needs to change.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm going to take a call now from Stuart Taylor, who I think has some very strong opinions on this issue. Stuart, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Diane, and hello, Mr. Cohan. I'll try to be brief. I've written a book. I'm not disinterested, but I am well informed. It's called Until Proven Innocent, Political Correctness and the Shameful Injustices of the Duke Lacrosse Rape Case. It strongly argues that the players were innocent. My co-author is Casey Johnson. My question for Mr. Cohan is whether any of the following three comments are wrong. Number one, this book adds not a single piece of significant new evidence to that which convinced then North Carolina Attorney General Roy Cooper and virtually all serious analysts by mid-2007 that the lacrosse players were innocent of any sexual assault on anyone.
Okay.
Unless one considers as new evidence Mr. Cohan's stunningly credulous interviews with three far from credible participants in the drama, Nifong, Crystal Mangum.
You're going to have to
Steele.
Be brief, Stuart.
Lastly, what Mr. Cohan just said about being the first to get the report of the sexual assault nurse Tara Levesey is clearly false. Dozens of reporters, including me, have had it since 2006. Mr. Cohan could have found it prominently displayed in our book. Thank you.
All right.
Well, I guess you see, Stuart Taylor, who wrote his book with Casey Johnson in 2006, it was published in 2007, clearly does not want to take into account any of the new information that has come out in terms of the police reports, in terms of, yes, Tara Levesey's report. He obviously doesn't care or want to hear what Mike Nifong would have to say or Crystal Mangum or Bob Steele. Basically, I have tried to present all sides to this fairly and dispassionately. But the haters like Stuart Taylor don't want anything to do with a fair and dispassionate assessment of this case. They are so wedded to their point of view of the fact that these kids were railroaded and were declared innocent and therefore must be innocent. They don't care about the fact that Roy Cooper, the Attorney General of North Carolina, will not make his investigative material public. I've had to sue him in North Carolina as under a Freedom of Information Act request to try to get access to that information. He declined all my requests to be interviewed. If these kids are, quote unquote, so innocent, why wouldn't Roy Cooper be the first to talk to me, and why wouldn't he make his investigative investigative material available publicly.
Where are these young men now?
So the three indicted players, they've got their $20 million. One of them is in private equity firm in New York. One of them works for Deutsche Bank in New York. And one of them went to law school and is now a clerking for a federal judge in Camden, New Jersey.
William Cohen, the book is titled The Price of Silence, The Duke Lacrosse Scandal, The Power of the Elite, and the Corruption of Our Great Universities. And he's telling you to make up your own mind. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from PBS with the